KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Mexico's president says the U.S. backed off tariffs for now. President Trump also promised tariffs on China and Canada. How will that affect Americans? Two economists talk it through with us on Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, we also have the true story of false reports about immigration raids. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The administration is deporting many people without legal status. Many other people find false alarms and hoaxes on social media. Also, an opera composed 138 years ago gets its first ever full performance. It's Monday, February 3rd, a big day for constitutional amendments. In 1870, the 15th Amendment assured the right to vote regardless of race. In 1913, the 16th provided for a federal income tax. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The 25% tariffs that were set to take effect on Mexican imports on Tuesday are on hold for 1 month. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum spoke to President Trump by phone today. She pledged to send 10,000 of her country's National Guard troops to the border to better prevent drug trafficking into the U.S. Trump had cited significant drug activity as one of the reasons for the tariffs. Trump is also expected to speak to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau again later today to discuss the 25% tariffs that are set to take effect in that country tomorrow. The headquarters of the U.S. Agency for International Development is closed today, and employees in Washington, D.C. have been told to work from home. NPR's Shannon Bond reports the move comes amid turmoil within the agency.
USAID workers got the closure notice in an early Monday morning email. The agency manages billions of dollars in federal humanitarian assistance around the world, but its work has been thrown into upheaval in the last week, with nearly all its programs halted. Over the weekend, the USAID website was taken down without explanation. Tech billionaire Elon Musk says his Department of Government Efficiency is shutting down USAID entirely. Musk says President Trump supports the move. Trump accuses the aid agency of being poorly run. Senate Democrats say shuttering USAID would require congressional approval. The White House hasn't commented. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
A Marine battalion has landed at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. NPR's Luke Garrett reports the service members will expand a facility meant to hold migrants detained in the U.S.
President Donald Trump wants to send 30,000 migrants to Guantanamo, a facility that's held at most 800 people. On Sunday, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem told NBC News that the facility is, quote, building out some capacity.
We appreciate the partnership of the DOD in getting that up to the level that it needs to get to in order to facilitate this repatriation of people back to their country.
Guantanamo Bay is widely known for its military detention camp that's held terrorism suspects following the attacks on September 11, 2001. When asked, Noem said it was not the plan to hold migrants at Guantanamo indefinitely, but rather to have a process that follows the law. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
The head of the World Health Organization is urging world leaders to call on President Trump to reverse his decision to withdraw from the agency. The organization is warning that the United States will miss out on critical information about global disease outbreaks. A budget document presented at the agency's latest meeting showed the program has a heavy reliance on American funding. This is NPR News in Washington. President Trump's order to end diversity, equity, and inclusion in the federal government has prompted many changes. At the National Cryptologic Museum, exhibits celebrating women and minorities in the museum's Hall of Honor were covered up. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports those covers were later removed after online protests from former National Security Agency employees.
The museum, located in Maryland, focuses on the secretive National Security Agency, which gathers intelligence by intercepting foreign communications. Those whose contributions were covered up included Washington Wong, who worked as an interpreter for NSA directors for four decades, and Anne Karakristi, who served as the agency's deputy director. When photos appeared online showing the exhibits covered with brown paper, it triggered an uproar. Writing on X, Larry Pfeiffer, former CIA chief of staff, called it disgraceful and began organizing a group to go to the museum Monday. The museum then relented, saying on X, quote, "We have corrected a mistake that covered an exhibit, but offering no explanation." Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
Several people remain hospitalized after a small plane crashed in Philadelphia on Friday night. Seven people were killed and nearly two dozen others were injured. The National Transportation Safety Board says the medical transport plane was in the air for less than a minute before it went down in a busy section of Northeast Philadelphia. Stocks continue to trade lower at this hour on Wall Street. The Dow was down 167 points, the Nasdaq Composite down 223. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, Israel's prime minister visits President Trump. First, we get two perspectives on the trade war the president launched over the weekend. The president signed executive orders imposing tariffs on three big trading partners. This news is changing quickly, we should tell you. Stock markets plunged early this morning and then rose again suddenly when Mexico's president said the U.S. has paused her country's tariffs for a month. Trump's other tariffs are still expected to go into effect, at least as far as we know, 25% on most Canadian products and 10% on China. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave a televised address warning Americans.
Tariffs against Canada will put your jobs at risk, potentially shutting down American auto assembly plants and other manufacturing facilities. They will raise costs for you, including food at the grocery stores and gas at the pump.
Trudeau went on to announce retaliatory tariffs on more than $100 billion worth of U.S. goods sold in Canada. China says it plans to file a lawsuit through the World Trade Organization. So much to discuss here, and we brought in two economists to help us. Peter Morici is an economist at the University of Maryland, writes for the Washington Times, and Ernie Tedeschi is a former chief economist at the White House Council of Economic Advisors under President Biden. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
Peter, let's start with you. And I want to ask particularly about the Americans' neighbors. We already had tariffs on China. Now there's going to be some more. The tariffs on Canada and Mexico seem somewhat newer. How intertwined are the economies of the United States, Canada, and Mexico?
Oh, incredibly so. We've had essentially free trade with Canada on automobiles since the 60s and free trade overall, since the 80s. Cars move back and forth across both borders. Cars contain their parts and vice versa. Also, we import prodigious amounts of electricity from Canada, and it has a big lever there if it chooses to use it. It can tax those or it can limit them.
Ernie Tedeschi, Prime Minister Trudeau is arguing that tariffs charged on Canadian goods is going to cost American jobs, given that interconnection we just heard about. Is he right?
Absolutely. So 20% of the cars that we buy in the United States are produced in Canada and Mexico. But like Peter said, it goes beyond that. The car industry in America is so interconnected with Canada and Mexico. It's not just that we buy cars that are completed in Canada and Mexico. It's that cars are started in Canada and Mexico, and then perhaps completed in the United States. Parts come from Canada and Mexico. It is a symbiotic relationship between the three countries. And so putting tariffs on Canada and Mexico really upsets that symbiotic relationship and would lead to job losses.
I want to figure out, gentlemen, what's really going on. The president officially has said, I'm doing this because of fentanyl trafficking. We have noted on NPR there seems to be very little fentanyl coming across the U.S.-Canadian border. There does seem to be a problem on the Mexican border. But some of the president's other statements, his own statements, suggest that's not really his motivation here. He's talked about a trade deficit the U.S. runs with Canada. He says these countries are ripping us off. He doesn't like the economic terms of the deal, and he's using whatever reason he can to impose tariffs. Let me just put that question out there for you both. And let's talk about Canada, say. Is there some way that Canada is ripping off the United States?
No. This is ridiculous. Canada is not a source of fentanyl. It's not a real source of immigrants, and it's certainly not ripping us off. The trade is based on comparative advantages. It improves economic efficiency, and it makes us live and them work and live better. It's that simple. With regard to Mexico, we have gripes on fentanyl, and we have gripes on immigration. But if those can be resolved, it isn't clear that we know what Trump really wants, because he doesn't say, give me X, Y, and Z, do these things, and then I'll take the tariffs away. Rather, he just says, I'm unhappy. He's like a child who says, I'm happy. What will make you happy? I'm just unhappy.
Well, I mean, he's essentially saying, I believe in tariffs, right? He's now talking about tariffs against the European Union, even against the UK, very close U.S. allies.
That's absolutely correct. And this is absurd. It's going to divide the alliance. It's going to drive the Europeans to try to cut a deal with the Chinese, caving to the Russians on Ukraine, and so forth. This is just a piece of a bigger puzzle. He's also cut off foreign aid. Talk about creating an opening for Chinese soft power in the global south. It's hard to say that this is a rational policy pursued by a rational human being. I think Republican senators understand that, and the fact that they're not speaking up indicates how much he's got them cowed.
Ernie Tedeschi.
I agree with Peter. You know, there seems to be this sense in the White House that trade surpluses are good and trade deficits are bad. There are cases where that may be the case. But look, you know, we have a trade deficit because the United States is a rich country and we are using our high income to buy goods and services from other countries that we would otherwise not produce here, that we like from other countries. In this case, Canada and Mexico. That's not a bad thing, because we choose to use our productive capacity for other things. Trade surpluses don't necessarily save a country or create an economic miracle. Germany produces trade surpluses consistently from year to year, and Germany has seen economic stagnation over the last 5 to 6 years because those trade surpluses have also made it dependent on the economies of its trading partners, in this case, China in particular. And that has made it too intertwined with the economies of other countries. So, you know, too much trade surplus can also be a bad thing.
There's another side to this. I agree with everything that Ernie said. There's another side to this. We have a huge budget deficit, 7% of GDP, which means we don't have enough savings in the United States. And basically, it's complex. But the way we finance that deficit is by basically selling U.S. treasuries abroad, and that leads to a trade deficit. Until we're willing to live within our means, either tax ourselves more or spend less in Washington, we're going to have a big trade deficit. It's that simple. That's an iron law of macroeconomics.
Let me ask one other thing, though. Ernie Tedeschi mentioned China. In the 30 seconds or so we have left, do you view the tariffs on China any differently? 10% tariffs on China where there already were some tariffs?
I do, yes. My feeling is that China is not based on comparative advantage, trading unfairly, and a large decoupling from China makes sense.
Okay, that's Peter Morici. Ernie Tedeschi, I got a few seconds for you. Any thoughts about the Chinese tariffs?
I think that I agree that it is different with China, but awaiting more clarity from the White House on what exactly the goals are there in terms of what they want to achieve.
Ernie Tedeschi and Peter Morici, both economists, politically different, similar opinions on these tariffs here this morning. Gentlemen, thanks to you both.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington, D.C. today.
He's here at the invitation of the president, and tomorrow becomes the first foreign leader to meet with Trump in his second term. Here's Netanyahu as he left for his trip.
I think it's a testimony to the strength of the Israeli-American alliance. It's also a testimony to the strength of our personal friendship.
They certainly have things to discuss. A ceasefire in Gaza between Israel and Hamas is holding in its third week as talks about the next phase of the deal are scheduled to begin today.
To talk more about all of this, we're joined by NPR's Kat Lomsdorf in Tel Aviv. Kat, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
Tell us what we know about Netanyahu's visit to the White House. What can we expect?
Yeah, Trump and Netanyahu have a lot to discuss, some of which is left over from Trump's first term, things like the Abraham Accords and the normalization of relations with Saudi Arabia. Also, how to deal with Iran, that's Israel's big enemy, but also a country that Trump has focused on a lot, too. But more immediately, there's Gaza. Just in the last week or so, Trump has been adamant about the very controversial idea of relocating Palestinians in Gaza out to neighboring Egypt or Jordan, he says, in order to allow for rebuilding. Both Egypt and Jordan have rejected that idea. Palestinians in Gaza also don't want that. And then there's the ceasefire deal, which is now in the middle of the first six-week phase, but talks of the next phase are supposed to start today. So they will most certainly be discussing that as well.
Kat, what can you tell us about this next phase of the deal? What do we know?
Yeah, details are still being hammered out. That's what the talks starting today are for. The talks will look a lot like they have in the past, with the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt acting as mediators between Hamas and Israel. We know that the second phase is crucial to ending the war. President Biden, who helped create the framework for this deal, did outline some of it. In the second phase, male Israeli soldiers who are being held hostage in Gaza will be released. We haven't seen that so far. In exchange, more Palestinian prisoners and detainees are expected to be released, and the remaining Israeli forces in Gaza will withdraw, which will lead to a permanent ceasefire.
And what about the process for all this? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, Netanyahu is meeting with U.S. Mideast envoy Steve Witkoff today in Washington. Witkoff has been instrumental in getting this agreement implemented, and he and Netanyahu are expected to talk about phase two. Witkoff's been talking with other countries ahead of today's talks. He spoke with Egyptian negotiators yesterday, for example. What we don't know is what demands each side might make that could derail the deal. For example, Netanyahu has a lot of pressure from key far-right members in his government to demand the elimination of Hamas in Gaza. Hamas still appears to control Gaza very much so, even after more than a year of intense fighting with Israel attempting to eliminate the militant group. Netanyahu's in a really tricky political situation here, where those far-right members have threatened to leave his government and collapse his coalition if he doesn't secure this as part of the deal. On the other hand, President Trump has been fairly clear about wanting the deal to go forward and continuing the ceasefire. So there are some areas of potential disagreement, and it's something we're going to be keeping a close eye on.
That is NPR's Kat Lomsdorf in Tel Aviv. Kat, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the difficulty of confronting death when it's your adolescent child who's dying. Even some in the medical field don't talk about death realistically with child patients or their families. When is hope helpful, and when is it just denial? We talk with Sarah Wildman of the New York Times. Her daughter died of cancer at age 14. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A long-lost opera finally gets its complete world premiere today. Matt Bloom of member station WWNO met the artists giving voice to a long-lost opera by a native son of New Orleans.
That composer is Edmond Dede, who completed his opera Morjane 138 years ago. It's never been performed in full until now. This performance of excerpts took place in January at St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans, where composer Dede was baptized nearly two centuries ago. Giovanna Joseph is the artistic director of Opera Creole, which helped bring the opera to the stage. The music, she says, has roots in the forgotten heyday of opera in the southern city.
Opera has been a part of our DNA. New Orleans gets a lot of credit for the birth of jazz, but the role of New Orleans in classical music and opera doesn't get as much attention.
New Orleans was once considered the country's beating heart of opera. In 1796, the city began staging regular performances with people of all races and backgrounds.
You had operas being presented by free people of color, enslaved people who had skills that they could hire themselves out on the weekend as iron workers or plasterers, those sort of things. They would save their money to buy their freedom, but they also bought a ticket to the opera.
What happened? What changed?
Jim Crow laws is essentially what happened. We got to the point of kicking people out of the French Quarter, kicking people out of the classical arena.
And that's exactly what happened to Edmond Dede. He was born into a free family of color in New Orleans in 1827. His father, a clarinetist, encouraged his musical interests. But Dede faced discrimination. He left for Mexico, returned home to work as a cigar roller, then left for good. He fled to France as the American Civil War loomed. There, he was celebrated as he composed and conducted orchestral works, art songs, ballets, and operettas.
These composers remind us that even though we still have tough times today, always remember you have to be determined to be who you were born to be and let nobody get in your way of that.
Joseph says the composer spent years working on Morjane, but the French theater scheduled to premiere it changed leadership.
And his relationship was, we're guessing, was gone. He presented it to Paris Opera, but it was never picked up. And so there it sat.
For around 100 years, after twists and turns worthy of a mystery novel, Harvard University purchased the 550-page handwritten score from a collector. Joseph, whose company wants to revive black opera traditions in New Orleans, learned of the score and quickly worked to get Marjane on stage. She enlisted the help of another organization, Opera Lafayette. That group's artistic director designate, Patrick Quigley, says it took more than a year to decipher the manuscript.
In some places it's smudged. In some places we can't necessarily make out the handwriting of the instructions or the libretto.
Dede wrote and rewrote the music many times, scribbling notes in the margins. Marjane is a four-act opera in French, based on themes from the Arabic folktale Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. Quigley says Marjane's score is full of surprises.
This is like, you know, eight lines going at the same time, all doing different things, very complex harmonies, yet it feels so natural and accessible when you're listening to it.
Dede's score is lush, romantic music influenced by French and Italian traditions, with hints of the American South. Marjane is cast with local New Orleans singers and instrumentalists. Some artists have national and international cachet, like soprano Mary Elizabeth Williams, who sings the title role.
I feel like I'm playing in a new sandbox that nobody else has been in yet.
Williams jumped at the role. She sung in young artist programs at the Seattle Opera and at the Paris Opera.
It energizes me because it exercises muscles in my brain that I don't normally use when I'm singing Puccini or Verdi or Bellini or Wagner or any of these composers, let's say, that are well-worn.
And well-worn is what Williams hopes for Dede's Marjane. It's important, she says, that a significant work of American musical history not be lost forever.
I'm glad to be a part of writing that wrong.
Finally, 122 years after Edmond Dede's death, Marjane receives its full premiere tonight in Washington, D.C., before heading to New York City and College Park, Maryland. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Be welcome to one of the wonders of the world. Be welcome to the Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal. President Trump says we're taking it back. And his new Secretary of State is in Panama to push the case. Many locals are shocked.
That was something that we weren't expecting, you know, in our 2025 bingo card.
I'm Ari Shapiro, hosting All Things Considered from the Panama Canal on NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. President Trump says after speaking with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, he will pause 25% tariffs on Mexico. Mexico also agreed to pause tariffs on the U.S. and to reinforce security at the U.S. border. Trump's tariffs on Canada and China are still set to go into effect at midnight. USAID workers at the Washington headquarters today were told to stay away and work remotely, as tech billionaire Elon Musk says his Department of Government Efficiency is in the process of shutting down the agency. NPR's Luke Garrett has this report.
During a public conversation with Senators Joni Ernst of Iowa and Mike Lee of Utah on his social media platform X, Musk says he's closing down USAID.
And USAID is a ball of worms. Mm-hmm. There is no apple. And when there is no apple, this you've just got to basically get rid of the whole thing.
Musk says President Trump backs the effort.
Actually checked with him a few times. Said, are you sure? I'm like, yes. So we're shutting it down.
USAID was first established in 1961 when Congress passed the Foreign Assistance Act. In 2023, it managed more than $40 billion in federal spending on humanitarian development and assistance in more than 100 countries. The State Department has yet to comment. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. South Africa's president says he hopes to engage with Trump after Trump threatened to withdraw funding for his country. The U.S. gave some $320 million to South Africa last year. Kate Bartlett has this report.
President Cyril Ramaphosa's statement came after Trump alleged the country was confiscating land and, quote, treating certain classes of people very badly. 30 years since the end of apartheid, most commercial farmland in South Africa is still under white minority ownership. The government recently passed a bill aimed at addressing that, but contrary to Trump's claim, no land has been seized. Ramaphosa also responded to Trump's threat to cut off funding. Here's his spokesman, Vincent Magwenya.
With the exception of the PEPFAR aid, which constitutes about 17% of South Africa's HIV/AIDS program, there's no other significant funding that is provided by the United States to South Africa.
He said the U.S. remains a key strategic, political, and trade partner. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
The stage is set for Sunday's Super Bowl. Both the Philadelphia Eagles and the Kansas City Chiefs have arrived in New Orleans. Thousands of visitors are also expected, and New Orleans says security is a priority with added law enforcement. 1 month after a deadly ISIS-inspired truck attack early New Year's Day targeted the heart of the city. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Overnight, USAID employees received an email stating the Washington headquarters is closed and telling them to stay home and work remotely today.
Nearly all the programs funded by the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, have been halted. President Trump seeks to remake the federal government and push the limits of executive power. In this case, the administration appears to be targeting an agency that was created by law, by an act of Congress. Right now, its website is down. Hundreds of employees and contractors have been let go in the past week. And we have reports that Trump is considering trying to fold the agency into the State Department.
White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has been following all this, and he's with us now to tell us what he knows. Good morning, Franco.
Good morning, Michelle.
So the president said something to reporters about this last night. What did he have to say?
Yeah, when he got back to the airport in Washington, Trump really tore into the agency, basically charging that it was poorly run.
It's been run by a bunch of radical lunatics, and we're getting them out. USAID, run by radical lunatics, and we're getting them out, and then we'll make a decision.
Did he give any evidence that this agency, as he said, is run by radical lunatics?
No, he did not. And he and his team, you know, do want greater control over the department or with the work that they do. They want greater control over the spending, and they feel that too much money is going to causes that are not in U.S. interests. Now, lawmakers are concerned. Democrats have actually warned that Trump cannot just shut down USAID on its own without going through Congress.
A few hours after Trump spoke, Elon Musk, the tech mogul who is running this Department of Government Efficiency, spoke on X, which he owns, about his plans.
Yeah, he is definitely has big intentions here. He says Doge is in the process of specifically shutting down USAID, and he emphasizes that he could not do that without the support of the president. He actually said he went over it with Trump a few times. He asked him, was he sure? You know, I mentioned earlier that Congress was concerned about all this. Musk didn't mention any statute or authority that would allow the president to basically skip Congress and shut down the agency unilaterally. That said, Trump does seem to be standing behind Musk, saying that he is doing a great job, while even acknowledging that they might not agree all the time that he's behind him.
Are there concerns that this new entity that this administration created, DOGE, is exceeding its authority?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, DOGE, of course, is this department that's tasked with leading substantial cost cutting, you know, and it's not just about shutting down the department. You know, over the weekend, there were reports of two security officials at USAID who were put on administrative leave for refusing DOGE access to certain systems. Democrats have accused DOGE of inappropriately accessing, you know, classified materials, which the lawmakers are saying they're going to investigate. I will note that their spokesman, DOGE spokesman Katie Miller, said no classified material was accessed without clearances.
And does this tie in with other changes happening under this administration, or if so, how?
Michelle, it caps off like such a week of chaos. USAID was not the only website taken down. Some other websites were down temporarily. There is just so much fear and uncertainty across the federal workforce, and it really does look like that's all by design.
That is White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
People without legal status are having to distinguish between real threats and fake ones. The Trump administration really is saying it wants to increase immigration enforcement. And people are also the targets of false alarms and hoaxes. NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports from Northern California.
Mi gente, noticia de última hora.
Last week, social media posts spread quickly in Sacramento's immigrant community, claiming there would be immigration and customs enforcement checkpoints along some of the city's biggest streets.
Compartan, difundan esta información.
Share and spread this information, said one TikToker to her 36,000 followers. But there was no sign of ICE checkpoints in Sacramento. ICE did not return a request for comment. The agency has previously said that it doesn't use checkpoints.
I don't see nothing like that.
That's Mario, a construction worker from Mexico who's been here for 30 years without legal status. Because he fears deportation, he asked to only use his first name. He saw the false checkpoint posts, and like many people these days, social media is the main way he keeps up with the news.
TikTok, basically, yeah.
He's angry, though, that some wannabe influencers are adding to the climate of confusion and fear in what appears to be a strategy to get more likes and views.
If you want to be TikToker famous, do something serious, something interesting. Don't play around with it.
In Maryland, there were false claims about ICE agents at a church food pantry. In North Carolina, a prank made it look like immigration enforcement was outside a grocery store. As a result, local community groups that work with immigrants are being flooded with inquiries, says Autumn Gonzalez. She's a volunteer attorney with the group NorCal Resist.
Mostly they're asking, is this true? And they'll share like a social media post and they'll say, should I go to work? should I take my kid to school? It's just really sad.
Gonzalez's group is one of many community organizations around the country trying to get vetted information to immigrants. They're asking people to send them tips about suspected immigration enforcement so they can send volunteers out to verify what's happening. Gonzalez did this work in the first Trump administration as well, but she says it seems like local rumors are more of a problem these days.
I don't know if there's less local trusted media that people can access without, you know, paywalls and all of those kinds of things happening that are pushing people to get all of their information from places like TikTok, but it really just seems super prevalent right now, and it's really hard to counteract.
Some posts seem to be accidental false alarms, but Gonzalez says when she asked certain social media accounts to take down warnings that turned out to be untrue, they left the posts up.
So at that point, I really have to think that they're just using this to harvest, you know, engagement for financial gain.
Nearby Modesto has also seen rumors lately. That's where I reached Chavez, who immigrated from Mexico to work on farms. He asked to just be identified by his last name because he does not have legal status. He said when he's seen unverified warnings about nearby immigration enforcement, it creates a dilemma.
Uno lo que siente rápido es la necesidad de pasar la información a los demás.
You quickly feel the need to share the information, but often, after things become more clear, you realize it caused a lot of worry, but it wasn't actually credible, he says. Amid all of this confusion, of course, is the fact that very real ICE activity has been confirmed in various cities around the country. Immigration arrests and detention numbers are going up. Jude Jaffe Block, NPR News, Sacramento.
This is NPR News.
Democratic Party, out of power after the 2024 election, is meaning to choose new leadership and maybe a new path forward. That's next time on Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. The Swamp Princess has officially become rap royalty. Dochi made history at the 67th Grammy Awards, becoming only the third woman ever to win Best Rap Album. Lauryn Hill won in 1997, Cardi B followed in 2019. Her mixtape Alligator Bites Never Heal earned Dochi the honor. The Tampa-born rapper accepted the award in tears, crediting sobriety and faith. She directed her speech to Black women and girls, saying anything is possible. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. A lot of people have a daily routine that they swear by, but it's probably nowhere near what tech entrepreneur Brian Johnson does. His day starts at 4:30 a.m.
I wake up, I turn a specific light on my bathroom that gives me sun-like exposure. I take 3 pills, go downstairs, start HRV therapy, so I put a little electrode here in my ear. I take 54 pills with a concoction that I call the Green Giant. I put a cap on my head for hair growth.
Then he works out for an hour, eats, does electromagnetic ab stimulation, followed by red light therapy for healing, audio therapy for his hearing, eats his last meal before 11 a.m., takes 34 more pills along with any other thing that his anti-aging protocol that he calls Project Blueprint has lined up for him. Johnson's routine and reasoning for this is the subject of a documentary streaming on Netflix titled Don't Die, The Man That Wants to Live Forever. He argues that he promotes a healthy lifestyle backed by science.
The irony is the majority of the things I do to achieve these health markers are the basics we already know, sleep and diet and exercise. I'm just consistent in those routines, and I also minimize environmental toxins and other bad things. But these things are free. They are available to most people, and mostly they're just topics of habit and choice.
But Johnson ain't your average Joe. He made a fortune when he sold Braintree, his online payment company, to eBay in 2013. And he's been using his fortune to fund his often stated quest for immortality.
I thought 4 years ago, what if I could build an algorithm for my health? What if I could Google Maps for my health, where it looks at all my data for my body, it consults all the scientific literature, and then it makes decisions in real time based upon what foods I should eat, exercise protocols, sleep protocols, therapies. And so that's what we've done. We've built an algorithm that takes better care of me than I can myself.
He has spent millions on a lab at home and staff who track everything about his health. And he pays for more experimental, untested treatments such as gene therapy. He's also selling products such as olive oil and supplements, which he claims can help you live longer. Medical experts in the Netflix documentary argue that what Johnson is doing is not real science and that it's dangerous. But Johnson says that people need someone to look up to, not another medical study.
The most powerful thing we could do on a global scale would be to make health cool. And so the biggest value is not another clinical trial. The biggest value is to change the global culture around health and give humans a new reason to want to live.
However, there's no guarantee that Johnson's medical experiments will work for everyone. Here's Matt Kaeberlein. He's a professor of pathology at the University of Washington in Seattle, who was interviewed as part of the documentary.
I think there's value in these individual N-of-1 experiments where people are testing different things on themselves, but it's never going to be accepted by the broader medical community or regulatory agencies. We need the more rigorous clinical trials.
And Johnson himself has admitted that some things he's tried have not worked. Take rapamycin, for example. That drug has been shown to slow down the aging process in mice, but it is unproven in humans. Johnson took over 5 years before stopping. He posted on X that he decided to stop taking the drug because of side effects such as infections and an increased heart rate. So what's the point then of Johnson's experiments, especially when death, as we all know, is inevitable, even if you find ways to try and slow it down? Brian Johnson says he wants to extend the horizons of what's possible, whether people agree with him or not. This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump wants to increase immigration enforcement not just along the border, but throughout the U.S. So Native American tribal leaders are preparing their members for more encounters with law enforcement. NPR immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo has the story.
Since Trump took office, tribal leaders are asking their members to carry their identification with them at all times. This is to prevent being arrested by immigration officials.
The history of us being misidentified is long.
That's Judith LeBlanc, executive director of the Native Organizers Alliance. Tribes from states like Utah, South Dakota, Nebraska, and more are working to get members resources in case their identity is questioned.
We have citizenship in our nations, and we are citizens of the U.S. That dual citizenship is a beautiful thing, really, in a lot of ways.
LeBlanc says tribal leaders are alarmed about reports of increased federal law enforcement activity. Tribal councils and leadership quickly began creating hotlines where members can report what's happening, putting out releases so members know their rights, and making it easier for tribal members to request their tribal ID cards.
Somebody could be picked up not having all the necessary identification forms with them, and who knows what could happen.
That's Mescalero Apache Tribal President Thora Walsh Padilla. Her tribe is within New Mexico. She was notified that a tribal member's identification was questioned by federal law enforcement. Immigration and Customs Enforcement did not respond to a request for comment, but they've said the agency may request identification if they encounter U.S. citizens while conducting fieldwork. The incident Walsh Padilla mentioned, paired with unconfirmed reports of encounters on Navajo Nation, prompted Southwest Democrats to write to Trump. They asked that ICE officers under Trump make sure to recognize tribal identification as they move forward. Still, concerns about law enforcement go beyond party politics.
We will be working to form broader coalitions of people who can work together for the implementation of the Constitution and the role of Congress.
LeBlanc from Native Organizers Alliance said she wants to work with other groups to ensure civil liberties are protected. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News.
The next big advance in treating rheumatoid arthritis could be tiny pulses of electricity. NPR's John Hamilton reports that scientists found a way to reduce inflammation without drugs.
The discovery began with an accident more than 25 years ago. Scientists gave rats a drug meant to stop inflammation in the brain. To their surprise, it also stopped inflammation in the body. Dr. Kevin Tracy says the reason was a signal sent from the brain to the immune system.
We realized that the signal was traveling down the vagus nerve, and the vagus nerve was like the brake lines in your car. It was the brakes on inflammation.
Tracy, now president of the Feinstein Institutes for Medical Research at Northwell Health in New York, says that realization led to a question.
Can we make devices that turn on the brakes and then treat patients with excessive inflammation, patients with rheumatoid arthritis, for instance?
Yes, apparently. A company co-founded by Tracy has developed an implantable device that's being reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration as a treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. Approval could mean an alternative to costly drugs that suppress the immune system. The milestone comes after decades of research on the vagus nerve, which Tracy says is actually a pair of nerves that connect the brain with internal organs, including the heart and lungs.
It's the only nerve in your body. If you cut it on both sides, you die.
A lot of the research has been done here at the Feinstein Institutes on Long Island. Dr. Stavros Zanos leads a team that's been mapping the human vagus nerve.
So I can show you what one of these nerve samples look like.
He holds up a clear tube containing a foot-long bundle of white fibers slightly thinner than a pencil.
So most of the vagus nerve from the brain to the neck to the half of about the distance through the chest.
Zanos shows me what a cross-section looks like under a microscope.
It's like a slice from a cucumber. So you see all of these tiny green spots, thousands and thousands of them. Those are individual fibers.
More than 100,000, Zano says, carrying messages to and from the brain.
A lot of the fibers inform the brain about the inflammatory state of the entire body.
Researchers here have been eavesdropping on those fibers in animals. Sangeeta Chavan explains how.
So we record the signals by placing electrodes on the vagus nerve. And those signals are then processed and converted into an audio file.
The rhythms of heartbeat and respiration are constant. But when researchers inject a substance that causes inflammation, a new sound emerges. Kevin Tracy says inflammation results in two-way traffic along the vagus nerve.
When inflammation occurs, molecules activate signals that travel up the vagus nerve, and in the brain, those signals are processed to become signals that travel back down the vagus nerve.
Those are the brake signals Tracy's team found decades ago. They tamp down the immune system so inflammation doesn't get out of control. And the company Tracy co-founded, Setpoint Medical, was able to build an implantable vagus nerve stimulator that acts like a brake pedal.
It's about the size of a large pill. So like if you think of a really big multivitamin.
Dr. Andrew Koh is a neurosurgeon at the University of Washington in Seattle. He was part of a study that placed the device in 242 patients with rheumatoid arthritis. The outpatient procedure requires a small incision in the neck, and Koh says the device is a lot like the ones already used to treat depression and speed up recovery from a stroke.
We initially started doing this for epilepsy patients. That's one of the earlier reasons for implanting vagal nerve stimulators.
In the arthritis study, about half the patients had reduced symptoms after 12 or 24 weeks of daily stimulation. Treatment also helped protect their joints from further damage and increase their chance of going into remission. The results suggest that vagus nerve stimulation could help at least some of the 1.5 million people in the U.S. with rheumatoid arthritis. And Tracy says the benefits may extend to other autoimmune diseases.
What's emerging is a picture that neural signals have the ability to reflexively control aspects of the immune system that, frankly, nobody had thought about before.
Already, the approach is being tested in people with multiple sclerosis, Crohn's, and inflammatory bowel disease. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Support for NPR Health Coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.